Father God, we come this morning in prayer, thanking you, Lord, for this day and this opportunity. Pray for your divine direction and guidance as we study your word. Direct us in our understanding, comprehension. And we pray and ask this of you in Christ's name. Amen. 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 Chapter 13, page 127, if you have the book.
Well, 127.
Depression or joy?
I'm here for that. Which one? What?
I'm trying to get to the Bible.
127.
All right, we're going to look at the subject of depression and see what the scripture has to say about it. Look at the last paragraph in that first section on page 127. It's going to begin with the phrase, a classic case study. Y'all see that? A classic case study on the symptoms of depression is found in 1 Kings 19. Which recounts the story of Elijah fleeing Ahab and Jezebel after standing against 450 prophets of Baal. It is a classic story of going from the pinnacle to the pit, from a spiritual high to the dark night of depression. Woven into the narrative of 1 Kings 19 is a dialogue between the Lord and Elijah that reveals what depression looks like and how it is expressed. Some of the symptoms would make Elijah a candidate for antidepressants if it had been available at his time. And the first symptom is fear. Okay, so turn in your Bibles to 1 Kings 19. And we're going to begin with verse 1. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with a sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So one of the first things that brings about depression is fear. Let's just read what he says. News that the 450 prophets of Baal lost their lives made Elijah a prime target. Not only did he not have the time to savor the victory of the Lord over his adversaries, he was now on the run and would soon be trapped by thoughts that would not have believed possible for a man of God. Fears can get out of control, which would be one of the wiles of the devil, to which Paul referred to in Ephesians 6. Our enemy knows what deeply bothers us, so he hits us there.
That's right.
The following list contains some of the most common triggers of depression through the years. Fear your grades aren't good enough for the college you want to attend. Fear you won't find a meaningful relationship with the opposite sex. Fear of being stuck in a dead-end career. Fear that the kids won't turn out well. Fear of a bad medical report. Fear that you don't have enough money for retirement. And the radio will booster all of those. They constantly hammer on those things because they know those are fears that people have. Where does fear come from? Fear comes from a lack of faith.
Let's look at our chart again, okay?
Remember, perfect love is to love God.
I need to hear it often.
And to love your neighbor. We fail to do that. We experience guilt. Guilt goes to fear. Or anxiety, same thing. And that goes to fleeing.
Right.
And depression is a type of fleeing. It is a sign that brings about fleeing. Depression is, okay? So, where did Ahab's, or not Ahab, where did Elijah's fear come from? A lack of trust in God.
That's right.
See, he failed to trust God after defeating those prophets of Baal. He forgot his calling. He was called by God to do that. He was directed by God to do that. And whenever you're called by God or directed by God to do something, quite clearly God is with you. And so the same thing's true in our life. God says, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. So you got to understand that God is always with us. Always. So when fear comes, the first thing you'll experience is the guilt. And you've got to stop and reckon yourselves, what am I fearful of? Why am I fearful?
Yeah.
I'm not trusting God. And you got to go back and fix it. Because if you don't, then you're going to start experiencing that. Clear?
So that's the key to it. The main thing we got to fear is our lack of faith.
Yes.
That would be the fear of God.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because see what this is talking about here is love for God. When we don't have faith in God, we're not loving Him.
That's right.
They're interchanged. Okay? People think of love being separate. Well, love is not separate. Love is encompassed in that. And if you love God, then you will fear God and not fear man. Okay? And so you just got to be able to push forward. But a lot of people, a lot of times we fail to trust God, and we fail to trust God, it's going to lead to sin. And it's going to create massive volumes of anxiety. And anxiety creates physiological symptoms that come with it, okay? Because once you start fearing, your body starts releasing cortisol, which is the number one chemical that's released. And massive dumps of cortisol are one of the leading causes for obesity.
Right.
Okay? So I see it in a correctional field all the time. Guys come into a correctional facility, and they come in out of training academy, been trained how to handle every situation in there. And within 6 months to a year, most of them have gained about 40 pounds. We have a severe problem with obesity in the prison. And it comes twofold. Number one, there is a massive amount of poor leadership in the subordinate ranks in the correctional field. Talking about lieutenants and captains, even some majors. They fear, or they lead, and I know this, I taught leader development for, 4 years? Solid to everyone from sergeant through warden. And so I get feedback from those guys constantly. Plus I went out into the field when I wasn't in a class. I was in the field interviewing people. And nailed it down. A lot of the subordinate leaders in there, and by subordinate I mean those what you call intermediate positions, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, they lead by fear. They lead by fear and public humiliation, which is the easiest form of leadership there is. I mean, it's a last resort leadership, but it is very effective and to get people to move, but it creates massive problems, you know. And so there's a certain level of fear when you work in a prison system with the people you're working around because you don't know when something's going to happen, especially if you're dealing with older criminals because they don't telegraph it. You know, the young ones come up and say, I'm going to whoop him. I said, dude, you wouldn't say that on East Ham or Wainwright or Memorial or Clements or one of these places, because they're going to kill you. I mean, the minute you tell someone I'm going to do something to you, they're going to get a shank. They're going to come up behind you and stick you. They're not going to wait for it to happen. And so there's a certain level of fear in there. Every time you walk through that door and that door shuts, you know where you are. And you know what you're around. And there's a certain amount of fear that comes with it. I've been there a long time, but I still, when that door shuts, I'm very aware of my situations. And I've had some hairy encounters, been in a bunch of riots and stuff, and it can be a very sobering thing take place. Well, if you don't know how to manage fear, one of the things fear does is it causes a massive amount of cortisol. Cortisol is a chemical produced in your adrenal gland, right next to your adrenal gland. It releases cortisol. Cortisol is what triggers the fight, flight, or freeze symptom in people. And it's there for a reason. It's to energize you to react. But if you're constantly under it all the time and you can't manage it, it will cause you to gain weight. It is a leading cause of weight gain, because one thing cortisol does is it starts limiting your leptin receptors. And leptin is a chemical that naturally reduces appetite. And so once your leptin sensors can't deal with leptin, you will eat and you will not be able to stop it. And then the more you eat, obesity produces chemicals that limit the effects of leptin, and so you get in a vicious trap where you just gain weight. And so these correctional officers gain weight. I'll never forget when I worked in MANL, they called me to the garment factory. Well, we were there, and they said, "Boss, I want to show you something." And it was the biggest pair of breeches they had ever made for an officer. And it was an 84-inch waist on them. 84 inches is overweight. Okay, I'll put it that way. I don't care how tall you are. And the thing is, the guy was 5'8" with an 84-inch waist. Now, 84, I'm about 76, so 84 is going to be about like this. That's how big that waist was. You think about that, man. That is massive. That is a massive. Well, I'll put it to you this way. That's about 75 right there, so 84 is going to be pretty much the width of that board. That's a big old waist right there, man. I asked them, I said, "How are y'all going to build a belt for that?" And they had to cut it off of a giant hide that they had. They had custom make his belt for the dude. But I had a lot of groceries. I'll put it that way. That's a lot of groceries.
Can you take it that skinny people have more faith?
Huh? Well, not necessarily, you know, because it can be manifested in other ways. But fear does do that. Fear will cause you, because if you eat, it causes a release of chemicals, dopamine especially, and it makes you feel good. But dopamine level from food's about 150 milligrams of dopamine per meal, something like that. I know that because cocaine's like 315. Cocaine's double what food does. And meth sits at about 1,500 milligrams of dopamine. That's why meth is so addicting. There's nothing like it. There's never been a drug like it ever invented. And that's why when people get on meth, it is tough to get off, because it controls the brain. You think of how good it feels to eat a meal and how good it feels to take a snort of coke. But I hope y'all didn't nod your head to that. Kathy, were you nodding your head? But a snort of coke would be double that. But meth, 1,500 milligrams? That's 10 times what a meal will do to you. You can't even fathom that. Can't even fathom that feeling, man. And I had an addict told me this week, he said, "The thing about meth is you don't take anything." He said, "You give everything away." Yeah. He said, "I gave away my job, gave away my family, He said, I gave away my savings account. I gave away every material possession I had to get that. He said, it is the biggest love affair you'll ever have. Because he said, you'll give away everything you have to have it. That's how bad it is. And it's crazy. Yes.
And it's more than that dopamine drop, because if you talk to a meth addict after the fact, when they've been clean for years, and you start talking to them about it, their eyes glaze over, mm-hmm. they get another dopamine drop when they're just thinking about the needle going in their vein. And they relive the high and the dopamine drop every time they think about the needle. And like I was talking to some yesterday, and their eyes are just glassy and glazed over, and I'm like, all right, dude, but you're not there anymore.
Uh-huh.
That's not who you are.
You're right.
That's why it's so hard for them to put it down, and they want to go back to it, even though it's destroyed their whole life.
Yep. I had a guy that worked gas pump at Wynn, done 7 on a 12 for meth, and he said, I made parole. He was all fired. I tried to lead him to the Lord, and he wouldn't have, He was a Hispanic guy. He talked with a real heavy Hispanic accent. And he said, oh, I don't need that, man. I don't need that. He said, I'm going to make it.
It's been my experience, CF, that the biggest fear that I encounter with people is simply the fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
They worry about everything.
True. Fear controls people's lives. You can be fearful of anything. You know, when COVID first came out, people were terrified they were going to get COVID. And it drove people to do irrational things, crazy things, man. You can't let fear. You got to understand, God, He's in charge, man. And it's constantly confessing your fear, trusting God. Confessing fear, trusting God. It's a daily walk, okay? Male depression. Look at the top of page 128. Shows you the difference between male and female depression. Male depression blames others, acts out as inner turmoil, needs to maintain control at all costs, which would be control freak, that kind of stuff. Overly hostile, irritable, attacks when hurt, tries to fix by problem solving, turns to sports, TV, sex, alcohol, feel shamed, becomes a compulsive timekeeper, terrified to confront weaknesses, tries to maintain a strong male image, tries to act away, turns to alcoholism and other addictions. Female blames herself, turns her feelings inwards, has trouble maintaining control, always tries to be nice, withdraws when hurt, tries to fix by trying harder, turns to food, friends, emotional needs, feels guilty, procrastinates, delays deadlines, exaggerates, obsesses about weakness, disintegrates at the slightest failure, tries to think through, increased appetite and weight gain. Sound like normal people, doesn't it? People say, well, man, I must be depressed. No, you do that to an extreme, okay? Is what he's talking about. He's not talking about limited amounts of that. But our enemy knows what deeply bothers us, so he hits us there. The following list contains some of the most common triggers of depression. We looked at them. So fear is a big one. The second symptom was isolation. If you look at 19, 3 and 4, it says, when he saw that, he arose and he ran for his life. And he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. A day's journey, just so you have it in your Bible, is about 20 miles. Okay, that was considered a day's journey in the Bible. Went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die. And he said, it is enough now, Lord. Take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. Yes. So isolation, he went a day's journey into the wilderness or desert. Dr. Philip Zimbardo, professor of psychology at Stanford University, wrote, I know of no more potent killer than isolationism. There is no more destructive influence on physical and mental health than the isolation of you from me and us from them. The only thing worse than being fatigued, exhausted, and burnt out like Elijah is having to go through it alone. After fleeing from Jezebel, Elijah came to Beersheba, a small town at the southern extreme of the Hebrew territory, the last stop before endless miles of nothing. He left his servant there, and while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. One of the dangers of depression is to turn inward and to hide from those who care the most for us. In an isolated condition, the mind starts playing games, causing you to hear voices that usually say scary things. In that kind of fog, it's difficult to know the difference between a truth and a lie.
That's right. We understand.
Isolation is a growing problem. Robert Putnam, author of Bowling Alone, discovered this after extensive research that involved 500,000 interviews over the last quarter century. He found that Americans have declining social connections, where they know their neighbors less,
That's
meet
right.
their friends less frequently, and belong to fewer organizations. In the last 25 years, families spend increasingly less dinner time together and 45% less time having friends over to the house. This lack of connection is not good for longevity or state of happiness. One surprising fact offered by Putnam is that joining one social group reduces odds of dying next year by 50%. People are social animals. I see it in prison system a lot. When people go into isolation, captivity, some people can handle it. In order to make it in isolation, you got to be either real smart or real dumb. I'm serious. You got to be able to do mental games with your head, or you're just really not aware of what's going on.
Right.
But if you're a normal person like myself, it'll drive you up the wall. You got to find something to do. You spent, 14 years? 11 years in isolation. Just exercising. You got to get you a routine. And you got to stick with your routine, or you will lose your mind.
Are you going to tell us which end of the spectrum you were on there? Really smart?
I don't know. That's
he's like me. He's in the middle, man. We're a regular dude.
That's for someone else to make the call, man.
You know, I see this passage with Elijah and Christ going into the wilderness. And both instances, the Lord came to them. And going into the wilderness sometimes allows you to hear the good and the evil.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering. Obviously, it has its benefit to, I mean, it's a dangerous place. I mean, Christ could have succumbed to the devil and said, hey, I'll take the world.
But, yeah.
You know, that's where the temptation, I'm just saying there's a...
Where are you going?
I don't know where I'm going. I'm just saying I see a corollary between these two passages.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It could be good or bad. The difference is Elijah went into the wilderness. With Christ, it says he was led into the wilderness.
Yeah.
So see, there was God directed him going alone versus him leaving out of fear. That's where I would draw the difference between the two, is that it says, and Christ was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, where he fasted 40 days and 40 nights. That was a part of God's plan to separate him, prepare him for ministry. Well, to prepare him for the temptation of the evil one too. Okay, question?
I talked to a man yesterday who was in AdSeg and...
Restrictive housing.
Restrictive housing is the new name for it. Administrative segregation is the
By
old
court,
name
we can't
for
say
it.
AdSeg.
But I'm not a...
You're not in it.
But
if I get reported, I corrected you, okay?
But he was very comfortable. And you can become very comfortable in a 5x9 cell? 6x9 cell, an area the size of your small bathroom in your house 24 hours a day. You become very comfortable in that environment, and he's like, well, I don't need to go anywhere. And I said, well, if you ever want to get out of the penitentiary, you need to go somewhere. If you want to spend the rest of your life in this cell, you're doing good. But if you ever want to get back out, you've got to make that. And he's like, well, yeah. And it becomes dangerous because it's not the Stockholm Syndrome, but it's something similar where you become very confident comfortable with your confinement. And that's what that isolation does, is isolation makes you comfortable with isolation. And the more comfortable you get with that isolation, the more you crave to be isolated, and you become an antisocial creature where you don't want to have any one-on-one interaction with anyone.
And they get nervous. You bring them out for rec.
Yeah, they don't
want to go. Cuffed up, man, they're walking like this. They're looking all over the place. They're walking around, turning, and doing all that stuff. I'm like, calm down, dude.
But,
you okay?
But they'll VR rec. They'll verbally refuse to go to recreation. And the officers like that because that's one less person they have to transport. And they'll verbally refuse going to the shower. And they'll literally, I talked to a guy yesterday who was 37 years in administrative segregation. Think about that, 37 years in a 6x9 cell. And he was very comfortable. He was a confirmed gang member. And he's like, well, I'm not going to quit that, and I'm not going to do this. But I said, man, you're getting out. You know, but you become comfortable in your isolation, and that doesn't build a healthy person.
What would it be that they don't want to get out because they fear... I'm going back to the thing.
You lose your ability to process stuff.
Right.
You take a person out of that environment, plop him out in prison. That's why we have a program called Savory. It's a program for violent or risky type offenders. We put them in that program. It's a SEG program. And we take them through a computer study, and they watch videos. First time they watch them, man, most of them start crying because they hadn't seen color. I mean, all they see is gray, white, whatever color the bars are painted every 4 years. But you put them in there and they see a TV, and they hadn't seen a TV in 30 years.
Right.
You see people talking, and they're just like, they'll start shaking. It's some weird responses from them and stuff. But we're trying to, because they're just going to be in line next to someone at Walmart the next day. You've got to make an adjustment from that environment to where he's in the world. And what they used to do is just turn him out.
Yeah.
They just turn him out on the street, and this guy would be marched out because he's too dangerous to be around staff. So they got him in leg shackles and cuffs, and they walk him out to the bus and undo his cuffs and undo his leg shackles, throw him on the bus. And then he's out running around in the free world. But he's too dangerous in the prison, huh?
Did they monitor that stuff to see how they responded publicly?
They did a USA Today article in the...
Once he's done his time, you can't do anything with him.
That's right.
Against the law.
1997, USA Today did a big study from the Texas prison system of when you're released from administrative segregation, restrictive housing, you usually have done your whole time. You don't make parole from back there. But USA Today...
It's called flat time sentence.
Right.
You flat time your time out.
USA Today did a study where they followed a dozen or so people that were released. And their parents, if they went to their parents' home, said, well, they took sheets and cordoned off their bedroom to make it small because the big bedroom made them uncomfortable. And they would freak out in Walmart or something like that, which I still freak out in Walmart sometimes. But they're completely ill-adjusted to be reintegrated to society. And the follow-up a year later, everybody that was released had reoffended and gone back to prison. Because, I mean, the recidivation rate for those ad seg inmates is like 90-something percent.
Yeah.
So see, I think in our society today, with all this COVID stuff, we've created our same scenario as being prisoners.
Similar.
And then if somebody sneezes around you, people freak out, you know, or every time you're sick, they run and get a COVID test. I mean, we've created this state of fear and then isolation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Oh, you're absolutely right.
I can assure you.
Creates paranoia. And apprehension. I mean, to where they got students now on college campuses and high school campuses protesting against not making masks mandatory. I'm like, come on, man. But that's what happens. People just, it turns people different directions and stuff. But it's a dangerous situation, man. I saw a guy in line at Walmart about 4 years ago, a midget, that paroled off of, that's what we called him. paroled off at Darrington, did one of the most brutal killings in the history of TDC, man, on video. We got a video of him stabbing a dude 130-something times. And he paroled straight out of SEG. And I'm walking in Walmart. I said, dang, that's Midget. What's he doing in here? I went up to him and said, what are you doing? I'm a free man. So I did all my time. I said, you got to be kidding me. I said, where'd you parole to? You Walker County? I'm like, of all the places you can parole, why don't you pick Walker County, brother? But I went down and told the ranger and sheriff, I said, this guy was bad news in prison. I said, he may be okay now, I don't know. But because I hadn't seen him in 25 years. I was there that morning when that happened. I was at Darrington working cattle. And man, they got one going in the building right now. And I run in there, check it out. And that's a dangerous little guy. They call him Midget. He's about 5'5". Little white guy about that big. Dangerous. But he spent his whole life in SEG. Came in when he was 18, got out when he was 52, something like that. I mean, that's a life right there. Isolation. That's what Elijah does. He gets alone, and it's not for good reasons. And what's he do? He turns inward.
That's right.
Okay? He turns inward. And he starts pulling away from people. That's something you got to watch for. People start giving away their possessions, stuff like that. That's a telltale sign that someone's entered into the suicidal zone when they start giving up their possessions and stuff like that. Self-pity, symptom 3. Take my life, for I'm no better than my ancestors. Collapsing in the shade of the broom tree, Elijah declared, I have not had enough, or I have had enough. He evaluated his condition based on a reasoning process forged in isolation and fear and succumbed to a poor me mentality. Millicent Fenwick said, never feel self-pity, the most destructive emotion there is. How awful to be caught up in the terrible squirrel cage of self. Very true. Self-pity is a bad thing. Very bad. Because see, what's happening in self-pity is, instead of focusing on God, you're focusing on self. Self is the essence of sin. Okay? So you're deep in the sin then. Faded faith. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. The fear, aloneness, and self-pity were the prime ingredients that caused Elijah to forget God's presence and his past faithfulness. That is typical for someone who is not thinking clearly. If Elijah's servant had been there, he might have reminded Elijah the famine that he had foretold had come to pass, his being fed by ravens, the widow's barrel of flour and jar of oil never running dry, the widow's son raised to life, God's fire on Mount Carmel had consumed the soaked altar sacrifice, the rains returning at his request, his ability with supernatural strength to outrace the king's chariots. You could go on and on and on and on. I'll tell you another example of someone in the Bible. John the Baptist. John the Baptist was locked up. And while he was locked up, he sent a request out to Christ and said, are you really the Christ? What's going on? He began doubting. Why is that? That isolation. That isolation will do it. And it'll cause a person to turn inward. I don't care how great. Because Jesus said about John the Baptist, said, of men born of women, he said, there's not been a greater prophet than John the Baptist. The greatest prophet in the Bible struggled with it. So it shows you that it can hit anyone. Suicidal, that's the next level. He came to a broom tree and sat under it and prayed that he might die. Psychologists say that people take their own lives when the pain of living is no longer bearable. In a physical, emotional, and spiritually depleted condition, Elijah thought death was the only way to ease his suffering. Abraham Lincoln felt that way at one point in his life. He wrote to his friend John Stewart, I'm now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on the earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell, I awfully forebode I shall not. To remain as I am is impossible. I must die or be better, it appears to me. Lincoln had moved from discouragement to despondency to despair. That's where irrationality sets in and thoughts of death become obsessive. The 5-year age span that has the highest suicide rate is the group from 80 to 84 years old. Primarily because so many live alone. That may seem surprising given the high rate of suicide among teens. Clearly, no one is exempt from depression, even those who maintain strong faith in Jesus Christ. Those who hit bottom and have suicidal thoughts need help. If a man finds a lump under his armpit, he goes to the doctor and immediately seeks help. He doesn't feel guilty for doing so. Likewise, we should feel no shame in seeking the best advice for dealing with depression, which is potentially lethal. It's a universal problem that affects people from all across the globe and with every social stratum, meaning there's no one exempt from it, okay? Exhaustion. Now, I think exhaustion plays a huge role, a huge role. Coach Vince Lombardi often quoted George Patton, "Fatigue makes cowards of us all." Patton stated flatly, "Staff personnel, commissioned and enlisted, who do not rest, do not last." Psychologists have given a name to the phenomenon that sidelines otherwise effective people. Vital exhaustion. This kind of physical breakdown has three characteristics. Feelings of excessive fatigue and lack of energy, increasing irritability, and feelings of demoralization. General Frushnik, you probably identify with that. In the military, there is a lot of sleep deprivation. A bunch.
When you're moving, you don't sleep.
Mm-mm.
And that can be for days.
Yeah, and we've been out there 7 days, never had an official bedtime. You know, I remember going, about the third day is the wall. That's when I started seeing giant eyeglasses walking and all kinds of weird stuff. But like y'all, when you fly, you'd have to go on flight ops, come in, debrief, and go back up. And just keep flying over and over and over. And you're expected to make all those maneuvers and stuff like this. You get numb after a while.
That's when crashes happen. We had one overseas fly into a mountain because he had no sleep. Yeah. Kill two people.
Yeah. And you lose a perception of what's going on. I talked to a Medal of Honor recipient, and I asked him. I was a young lieutenant. He came to our mess night. It was the first Medal of Honor recipient that I'd met after being in the military, Jay Vargas. And he at the time was a lieutenant colonel. And he got his Medal of Honor at the Battle of Dido. And what they had done is they had fought for 7 days straight without any sleep. And he'd been wounded 3 times already and did not seek medical attention because he said he had to keep his men going. His company, a company is normally 200 people. His company's strength was down to 38 men. And when they entered into the Battle of Dido, he came in on a flanking movement. And they actually, they didn't know this, but they had actually engaged 3 NVA regiments. A regiment's about 12,000 men, something like that. So about 36,000 men. All he had was 38. And then who was the other guy got the Medal of Honor there? There was 2 of them that got the Medal of Honor. He was with the other company coming in there. Well, when they started firing at him, they took after him. Jay Vargas had to make his men back up. They had to go back into a cemetery, and they dug the bodies out of the grave, and they climbed in the holes, and he called in artillery on his own position because the enemy was on them. They were hand-to-hand fighting. And so they said, when I call these rounds, get in the holes or you're going to die. And he just shelled it. He just flattened everything. He said it wasn't a tree, a bush, a headstone, nothing left. He said it looked like a prairie. But he said they sat through an intense bombardment for an hour and a half while they were in those holes and stuff. And I asked him, I said, when you received your Medal of Honor, I said, what was going through your mind? He said, I want to take a nap. That's what he said. He said the whole time, he said, I'm thinking about where can I go to sleep? He said, my body was shot. He said, I've been awake 10 days. With no sleep, he said, I'd eaten twice during that time. He said, I'd lost 30 pounds. Right. He said, I was bleeding. from three different places in my body. I'd lost all my men, basically. Every one of my men was wounded. And a lot of them, he said, were walking. He talked about one of his sergeants. He went to take ammo to him, and a sergeant's eye was hanging down on his cheek. Uh-huh. And he was still firing his machine gun at the enemy. He said it was just total devastation all around us. And he said, you do crazy things when you get in that situation. And that's what he attributed it to. He ran out through the open area, got his commander, carried him out, carried all of his men out, got every one of them out of there. All 38 of them. Got them to an evac, got out of there. But he said that extreme fatigue will drive you beyond human ability. And he said that's what it did, that exhaustion. So what I'm saying is this. Get some rest. Get some rest is a good thing because it'll bring it on. There's two critical things, man. Lack of food and lack of sleep will bring it on quick.
That's quick. When the adrenaline kicks in. And when the adrenaline kicks in, you don't realize any of that.
Mm-mm. No.
Just keep going.
Yeah, your adrenaline, you can live off your adrenaline because your mouth has that metallic taste to it. And you're just humming. You don't even think about eating. Say, dang, I hadn't eaten 3 days, man. You know, all of a sudden you're like, now I need to get something to eat. Or what I'd notice is my belt, man. I'd so like keep getting my belt kept getting tighter and tighter and tighter. My waist kept getting, it just sucks in on you. And you get wore out, just flat wore out, man. I come in one time from an operation and I fell asleep on the front yard. You remember that? I got out of the car. I fell asleep on the sidewalk, man. I couldn't go anymore. And Kathy come out and woke me up and said, hey, you get in the house, man. I was out there my pack of sleep on the ground.
Standing up.
Yeah.
Standing up for attention. I
fell asleep one time in a fire direction center, standing up, and someone woke me up, but I was dreaming. Yeah. The bad news, man.
In the Jeep,
right? Huh?
In the Jeep with your head on the dashboard.
Yeah. We'd move from one position to another. I tell my Jeep driver, wake me up when we get there. And he goes, it's only 5 minutes. And I said, well, I'm going to take a nap. And I'd lay down, man, my head would be bouncing like that, but I'd be sound asleep, man. It wouldn't matter. You're just so tired, you don't care, man.
There's pretty severe penalties for falling asleep once you watch.
Yeah, if you're out on guard duty. And what that is, when you come up on someone on guard post, they're asleep, yeah, real serious. But we're not talking about in those conditions. Those conditions, everyone's hauled out. Everyone wants to quit, and you're trying to keep them fired up, keep them going. And it's hard to do. Feeling rejected. I want to go ahead and get through this. Feeling rejected. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with a sword. I'm the only one left. Now they're trying to kill me too. Rejection, feeling rejected. God, I'm down at bold print one. God recognized that Elijah's depression was real. Maybe it was post-adrenaline depression. That's what it was. That adrenaline gone and you're over with, you're done. Often a walk through the valley can follow a significant victory. One day Elijah exalts his victory over Baal's prophets. The next day he wants to die. God didn't scold him for his feelings. He acknowledged Elijah needed help. God encouraged Elijah to rest. When you're worn out, you need rest. Sometimes the most spiritual thing you can do is eat your favorite meal and take a nap. I got a shirt I'm trying to get made. It says, Jesus took naps. Be like Jesus. That's what it's, and he did. He always was going alone and taking a nap. That's a spiritual thing to do. There's nothing wrong with it. Naps are a good thing. God encourages Elijah to rest. Number three, God didn't give Elijah counsel for a while. More beneficial than the power of well-spoken words is the power of presence. Anyone who has grieved deeply will tell you that they remember precious few words spoken to them during an hour of crisis, but they are forever grateful for the silent presence of someone they love and trust. 1962, during a difficult period in the Civil War, a Quaker woman and her friend found an audience with Abraham Lincoln for the purpose of prayer and spiritual support. Eliza Gurney, the widow of English Quaker Joseph Gurney, did not come to counsel Lincoln. Rather, in a Quaker's tradition, she came to spend long moments in silent and prayer for the president of a nation engulfed by the ravages of war. 2 years later, Lincoln would write to Elizabeth Gurney, "I've not forgotten, probably never shall forget, the very impressive occasion when yourself and friends visited me on a Sabbath forenoon 2 years ago." God allowed Elijah to explain the problem. That's very important. When someone's in a state of depression, let them talk. Let them talk it out. Dr. Paul Meyer, co-founder of the Meyer New Life Clinic, says that more important than prescription medicine as the antidote for depression is what he calls talk therapy. After the Lord asked, "What are you doing here?" Elijah rehearsed how faithful he had been for the cause of God, only to be isolated, persecuted, and abandoned by other believers. Elijah may have felt like he was the only faithful one left, but it was not true. Later, the Lord would reveal, "I reserve 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal, and all whose mouths have not kissed him." God dealt with Elijah's false beliefs. When people are in depression, they have false beliefs. What are Elijah's false beliefs? "God's abandoned me. No one is with me. I'm the only one." All those kind of things that he said. During World War II, the Allied forces came across a concentration camp in Cologne, Germany, that had the inscription scrawled on a cellar wall: "I believe in the sun, even when it's not shining. I believe in love, even when I do not feel it. And I believe in God, even when he's silent." God was ready to speak and Elijah to be reintroduced to God of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God gave Elijah something to do. Okay? "Go back the way you came to Damascus, anoint Hazael, king of Aram, anoint Jehu, Nimshi, king over Israel, anoint Elijah to succeed you as a prophet." In other words, Elijah, get back to work. God told his faithful yet depressed servant, do something useful. Find someone in need. Help that person. That's why ministry is so important. You give out. And then lastly, God gave Elijah a friend. Enter Elisha. The story begins a new chapter with the introduction of Elijah's new attendant and friend. Elijah was no longer isolated. Elisha was a gift from God, a brother, a co-laborer, exactly what Elijah needed. Okay? Those are all very, hold that chapter, mark it, whatever. And if you ever have to counsel with someone, follow those prescriptions. Very, very effective. Very effective in helping people that are in that situation, okay? We are out of time, but I wanted to get through that section and not break it up till next week, okay? So, that chapter in Kings 19 is an excellent chapter. It's an excellent chapter on that subject. One of the most thorough resources there is. So, I strongly encourage people to utilize that chapter, okay?